I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 530. Unwelcome guests. I'm Robin Upsner. This week's show is based around a documentary by Scott Noble called Human Resources. It's focused on the 20th century and it looks at how individuals were subjugated by especially governments, but also schools, manufacturers, commercial hierarchies, how the individual became less important than the idea of obedience. And to set the scene, we're going to hear a few remarks from Jonte Legato's speech from about a decade ago. So this is in the run-up to the 20th century, when the idea of forced schooling as a necessary evil was not yet established in society.
After the Civil War, certain utopian speculations about isolating children in compounds and subjecting them to deliberate molding routines began to be discussed seriously by the policy-making managers of business, government, and university life. These discussions were inspired by the potential for centralized mass production made possible by coal-driven machinery. Railroad development that was also dependent on coal, and startling new inventions like the telegraph. The principal motivation for this revolution in family and community life wasn't only greed for money, although that was there, but also the philosophical conviction which approached a religion in its intensity that early indoctrination would lead to an orderly scientific society led by the best people, unhampered by the democratic tradition or American libertarian attitudes.
So, with Gatto's cautionary note that not all of those involved had evil intent, let's hear Scott Noble's film. Metanoia Films, in association with I Am the Mob, presents Human Resources.
Give me a baby, and I can make any kind of man. These are the words of John B. Watson, the founder of behaviorism. According to this worldview, the behavior of organisms, including human beings, is predictable and therefore controllable. In 1920, at Johns Hopkins University, Watson experimented on several babies ranging in age from 3 months to a year. The experiments were remarkable in their simplicity. He would present a candle to infants to see if they were afraid of fire. He would introduce animals to their environment to see if the children were afraid of them naturally, or only after a traumatic experience. He would make a hissing noise and observe the results. Watson learned that newborn babies had no fear of the dark. He also learned, however, that such fear could be conditioned. And so it was with rabbits. This baby, known as Little Albert, initially found delight in touching a rabbit. Yet, as Watson began to clang a steel rod and claw a hammer behind the child's head whenever he touched the creature, the reaction became not one of delight, but terror. Soon, the mere sight of the rabbit would elicit fear, even when no noise was provided, a fear that also extended to objects and textures of a similar type. From his experiments, Watson reached a radical conclusion which would come to define political and social engineering in the 20th century. The driving force in society, he claimed, is not love, but fear.
L.J. Henderson, Harvard University. If people do the right thing, they don't need to be retrained. Rebecca Lemo, author of world as laboratory.
You can speculate about why the rat was so useful. I mean, one thing, it reproduced really fast. Another thing is that people were not affectionate towards rats, so you didn't really need to worry about ethical objections unless something truly horrible was done. And finally, I guess you could see the rat as a metaphor for an animal that is tractable. Running a rat through a maze, it's a pretty understandable metaphor for most of us of running through life. And in fact, if you look at the history of the maze, it goes back through early Christian and even into Greek societies as kind of a metaphor for life. The idea that you somehow wind your way through a maze. Of course, in the Christian tradition, the maze is full of meaning and you're eventually trying to get to God. It's kind of a pilgrim's progress. Whereas in modern society, people like Nietzsche said that, you know, life was like a maze that you could never run to the end of. But in the 20th century, in American laboratories, the maze was once again adopted as a symbol of hope, not a hope that one could get to God or get to a meaningful life, but the hope that people could actually be controlled in a very scientific manner, that social life could be remade on the basis of scientific principles.
In the roll call of scientific pioneers, few names will summon the passionate controversy as that which surrounds B.F. Skinner. His work has led to the formulation of the science of human behavior, which finds behavior to be predictable, therefore controllable. And for this, he has been both applauded and attacked. The science of behavior is based on the principles of operant conditionings. These principles and their practice have recently become known as behavior modification, sacrilege to some because it has to do with methods by which man can shape the behavior of others. But far from being a scheme to control people without their knowledge, it allows man to study and analyze behavior and to apply its healing potential to such fields as education, medicine, and psychology.
George Ritzer, author of The McDonaldization of Society.
Behaviorism, as it suggests, is the study of behavior. It's the notion that really all that matters is behavior and not the thought processes that lie behind behavior. And it also is very much a method of control. In behaviorism, there's the whole idea of behavior modification, where you can use various kinds of techniques to modify people's behaviors so that they stop doing what you don't want them to do, and they start doing what you want them to do. So I think it's the scientific aspect of it and the controlling aspect of it that defines behaviorism.
The philosophy of behaviorism is deceptively simple. It suggests that organisms can be viewed as flesh and blood machines. Like machines, we require fuel. Like machines, we can be put to work for a specific cause. Like machines, we can be repaired or redesigned for new purposes. And like machines, we can be compelled into performing a certain action at the push of a button. The science of human behavior had always intrigued philosophers, but it wasn't until the Enlightenment and the era of capitalist industrialization that men began to think that they could control life forms in the same way they controlled objects.
Morris Berman, author of The Reenchantment of the World.
Prior to that, when we think of the Middle Ages, even much of the Renaissance, the idea was that things were interrelated. They were organically a whole. In that sense, the Middle Ages had a lot in common with traditional peasant or folk cultures around the world. Things are seen as basically being a kind of giant web of influence. Everything was like a chain where if you plucked one part, the other part would resonate. That was the previous view, a worldview that had great advantages and also great disadvantages. With the scientific revolution in the 17th century, that view altered, in which things were seen as mechanical parts that interrelated. The mechanical philosophy of the 17th century was a very crucial step in the rise of capitalism, because capitalism does that. For example, it sees the earth at a distance. It sees the earth as something to be mined and exploited. It sees the earth as dead. So capitalism and the mechanical philosophy went together very well. And that, in many ways, made possible the Industrial Revolution, the rise of modernity, And there again, we can say there are great advantages to it and also great disadvantages to it. Civilizations usually come as a package deal. There's a light side and a dark side. Every civilization believes in its own propaganda, so it tends to emphasize the light side and forgets about the shadows.
For the behaviorist, it started with plants. Julius Sachs at the University of Würzburg enumerated a set of tropisms, defined as any directed response by an organism to a constant stimulus. An example is the way an ivy plant will turn its leaves toward the window in order to gain exposure to sunlight. Sachs' protege, Jacques Loeb, took it to the next level by creating a stable of insects he called durable machines. In his laboratory at the University of Chicago, he trained cockroaches through the use of simple tropisms. Because of the insect's bilateral symmetry, a light shone on one side caused it to move in the other direction. In Russia, Ivan Pavlov moved on to animals. The term Pavlov dog has become synonymous with the conditioned reflex. Pavlov discovered that a dog would salivate when it began to associate a stimulus, such as a ringing bell, with food. In America, John B. Watson finally graduated to human beings.
John Watson was an extremely interesting character in the history of American social science and also the history of American advertising, which is a not insignificant connection between the two. His dissertation in 1906 was about the kinesthetics of the rat as it navigated a maze, and his idea was that he could remove one by one the senses of a rat, like remove its ability to see, remove its ability to hear, its ability to feel, and then see whether the rat could still make its way through a maze that it had been trained to navigate. So in his mind, rats were always stand-ins for human beings and human subjects. He called it psychology as the behaviorist views it, and it was basically his manifesto for behaviorism. And in it, he declared that behaviorism was a science of human behavior and that there was a method available to make a technology by which human beings could be shaped in any way that a scientist desired. Watson always was interested in control. One finds this theme throughout his work. He said, "Give me a baby and I can make any kind of man."
Watson continued to experiment on babies and other living things until his star began to fade. At the end of his life, he wrote nostalgically of his failure to put together what he considered the ultimate experiment in social engineering, a multi-ethnic baby farm. "I sometimes think I regret," Watson wrote, "that I could not have a group of infant farms where I could have brought up 30 pure-blooded Negroes on one, 30 pure-blooded Anglo-Saxons on another, and 30 Chinese on a third, all under similar conditions." Watson's dream may seem bizarre to modern ears, but implicit in the concept was a real desire to see the question of race answered once and for all. He was not unlike thousands of other researchers at prestigious universities across the United States.
Sharon Smith, historian.
In the late 19th century, alongside the rise of Jim Crow segregation in the 1890s, what you saw is that corporations developed a much more elaborate way to justify the fact that the wealthy corporate elite, which was without exception white, to explain the reason why. That reason has its basis in what became known as the eugenics movement. You were born with either good genes or not good genes.
The 1934 film Tomorrow's Children.
"In the case of Miss Mason, I can see no reason for the operation that's been recommended. The girl is perfectly normal. She's hardworking and has a good reputation."
"Do you know anything about her family background?"
"Well, yes, Your Honor, I do."
"There are several other children, aren't there?"
"Yes."
"What is their condition?"
"One is a cripple. Two others might be classed as feeble-minded."
"Isn't the oldest son in jail?"
"Well, yes, I believe so."
"And knowing all that, you still contend that this girl should be allowed to bring more people like that into the world?"
"Those who have good genes should be encouraged to reproduce, and those who are, quote, unfit should be discouraged from reproducing, from having children." That eventually went into forced sterilization programs, which started in the United States, directed against African Americans, Native Americans, immigrants in particular.
Justin Chaco, author of No One is Illegal.
Eugenics was a pseudoscience rooted in the idea that you can, A, recognized pre-biologically determined differences in people based on their ethnicity, and that B, you could construct a policy that favors some ethnic groups over others, both in terms of immigration policy and in terms of integration into U.S. society based on this hierarchy of heredity. This pseudoscience, this philosophy, gained a lot of traction in the United States amongst the industrialist class, especially at a time when immigrant workers, who made up a large percentage, if not the majority, of workers at the turn of the 20th century, were beginning to form unions, were beginning to create collective organizations, their own political parties, to challenge the conditions of industrialization, which were horrific and oppressive. It took root in the universities. It took root amongst the highest offices of government. Calvin Coolidge, for instance, Republican president, believed that, and even stated his belief that, a lot of social problems were associated with inferior races. We see ultimately this philosophy is going to play an important role in shaping immigration policy after the passage of the Immigration Act of 1924, which essentially creates a national quota system that favors immigrants based on their ethnicity and based on their nationality.
One fact that is important to understand about the eugenics movement is that it was created and funded by the corporate elites that ruled America coming into the 20th century. It was the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, the Kellogg family of the cereal. They funded these research programs at universities, all of it created, funded by these corporate families. The Rockefellers in particular played a particularly devious role. As the eugenics movement developed, it went in a really horrible direction.
We humans have transgressed the law of natural selection in the last few decades. We have supported inferior life forms that look like this. Picture of inferior looking Jew. The Black Stork, 1917, an American pro-eugenics film, featuring a poor, bewildered looking mother and an authoritative, trustworthy doctor. It's a black and white silent movie, of course. The screen cuts to explanatory text. His blood is tainted through inheritance. I believe it wrong to operate to prolong an absolutely useless life.
The Rockefellers would play a key role in the advancement of social engineering in the years between the Great Wars. Between 1922 and 1929, an arm of the Rockefeller Foundation gave out almost $50 million toward the pursuit of the social sciences around the world. According to historian Judith C. Lander, the spur was a need for better organization in society at large. What had begun as a public relations ploy to assuage public anger in the face of unscrupulous business practices and violent suppression of working people, the Rockefeller charities would set out to change society as a whole.
Rebecca Lemon, author of World as Laboratory.
The Yale Institute of Human Relations was founded in 1929. It was given us $7 million initially from the Rockefeller Foundation just a couple of months before Black Tuesday occurred in October of 1929. So according to my calculations, if you factor in all the money that Rockefeller eventually gave the Yale Institute and the other monies from the government, this was the largest social science project that's ever been funded in history.
The desire for better order was epitomized by the Hawthorne experiments, which created a new model for organizing and supervising industrial workers. They are widely credited with putting the human factor back into industrial relations. Yet, as with previous experiments in the workplace, the ultimate effect would be to increase the power of the great capitalists at the expense of everyone else.
Only we're not automatons. We have eyes to see with, ears to hear with, and mouths to talk. Shop steward at GE Bridgeport. Forces of production.
The story of what is now termed scientific management, or Taylorism, begins decades earlier when Frederick Winslow Taylor was hired by Bethlehem Steel to increase efficiency in the industrial workplace. Once upon a time, the greatest theorist of the free market, Adam Smith, had warned that division of labor would create a catastrophe for human society. Frederick Taylor disagreed. In Taylor's view, there was far too little division of labor. Factories could be run far more efficiently if tasks were mechanized and broken down even further. In a series of experiments, he set out to reduce every task performed in a factory into individual units, measuring how long they took and setting targets for workers to meet. On its surface, scientific management seems like an excellent idea. Increased efficiency allows more products to be manufactured in a shorter amount of time. Yet there was another, more sinister motivation lurking in the background. Ever since the 19th century, machine shops had been a bastion of skilled labor. What this meant was that a considerable degree of power remained concentrated on the shop floor. The same skills that made production possible also enabled machinists to challenge management when they felt they were being treated unfairly. For management, this was an unacceptable bargaining chip. For Taylor, it was simply inefficient.
You find that the man does not change very much, whatever else changes. They boast in the aeroplane world, it will take some other countries a generation to catch up with our quality. And it is not because their engineers are inferior, but because our ordinary workmen have a tradition of skill behind them.
George Ritzer, author of The McDonaldization of Society.
Taylorism was certainly about de-skilling. It was about studying what skilled workers did to decompose those tasks into their basic elements and then teaching people to do specific aspects of it without learning the entire set of or array of activities that were involved and are involved for a skilled person. In that sense, it's a mechanism of control because you dictate to people, well, you do this part of the entire task and you don't do anything else, and you dictate to 8, 10, or 12 people various specific aspects of the whole task rather than allowing a skilled person to decide how the entire task should be done. So there's very much control involved there. To the degree that this involves de-skilling and involves control, it tends to take power away from workers, it takes power away from, therefore, the collectivity of workers, and therefore makes them less likely to be rebellious, makes them less likely to form various kinds of movements that would operate against, let's say, broadly, the capitalist system. So this is something that management thinks is a good idea for the workers, but is not a good idea for them. They have to be free to be creative. And in fact, Henry Ford, in his biography, said exactly that. Basically, he said something like, I'm too smart to have these kind of rational principles imposed on me, but those stupid workers out there, we need to impose those principles on them because they wouldn't know what to do if we didn't impose those principles on them. So rationalization, McDonaldization, is always something that those on top want to impose on the bottom, but something they don't want to affect their work at all. Henry Ford, in effect, invented the automobile assembly line and more generally the system that came to be known as Fordism. One aspect of Fordism had to do with hierarchical control over workers, and more specifically, the control over workers by the assembly line. So all a worker might do, for example, is put a hubcap on a car as that car went past as it was being constructed on the assembly line. So instead of a thinking, creative, skilled worker, you had a kind of mindless kind of worker who repetitively did the same task over and over again. Well, that kind of worker is robot-like. You are forced into a series of robot-like actions. The most interesting thing for me about McDonaldization, or Weber's broader concept of rationalization, is the idea of the irrationality of rationality, that these rational systems inevitably spawn all sorts of irrational consequences. This is supposed to be an efficient system, yet it ends up being very often inefficient. It's dehumanizing, one of the kind of ultimate irrationalities from my point of view.
In their study, Where Have All the Robots Gone?, Harold Shepard and Neil Herrick confirmed what many had long suspected. People trapped in an unrewarding work life were not only more likely to be dissatisfied, but were also more likely to suffer from low self-esteem, a feeling of helplessness, alienation, and to be plagued by a variety of mental disorders. The workers, who were the most dissatisfied and whose mental health was the most impaired, were the least likely to vote or participate in community organizations.
Michael Albert, co-creator of Paracon.
If you work in an environment where you're beaten up all the time, well, you're beaten up. Moreover, if you work in an environment that is so fragmented, that so robs you of dignity and so robs you of the expression of your own capacities, then they'll be diminished. You'll be deadened. You'll be bored. You will be reduced in your potentials. And you are not too likely to take initiative in other domains either. This is why Taylorism is pursued. This is why fragmenting of work is pursued. It weakens the workers, not just on the job, but in their communities too, which is what you want to do so that they don't take more of the income from themselves, thus reducing profits for the elites. So it's a perfectly sensible policy, a perfectly sensible approach, a devil's approach, but a perfectly sensible approach from the point of view of those at the top who are trying to stay there and who are trying to advance. Moreover, if they don't, they just get wiped out. So it's not even really an option. What you'd have to do is to create a new kind of economy in which these situations and these conditions don't restrict our options. The corporate entity, corporate person, it's not really a person, but call it an entity, is it pathological? Answer yes. Why? Because it drives toward profit regardless of the broader implications. It doesn't matter if your drive toward profit induces pain and suffering, promotes, you know, generates black lung disease in a mine, or pollutes the environment, or literally destroys the society. It doesn't matter. You're forced by the nature of the social relations inside and among corporations, the market system, to pursue, to accumulate, to pursue profits.
If hierarchy is the defining characteristic of scientific management, it should not be surprising that it was met with great praise, not only by the capitalist world, but by fascists and authoritarian communists. Mussolini set up a propaganda arm of his government to promote Taylorism, while Lenin wrote in Pravda in 1918 that we must introduce in Russia the study and the teaching of the Taylor system and its systematic trial and adaptation. As in America, workers in Russia were unimpressed with scientific management. A major contributing factor to the Kronstadt Rebellion of 1921 was the introduction of Taylor's techniques. Immediately after the rebellion was crushed, a government document on rationalization spoke of the instinctive mistrust of all workers toward all kinds of experiments directed at extracting greater productivity from them. Workers at Kronstadt had envisioned a decentralized system where they would actually own and control their own work and resources, but Lenin had something different in mind. Socialism, Lenin wrote, is merely state capitalist monopoly, which is made to serve the interests of the whole people and has to that extent ceased to be capitalist monopoly. The new means of control have been created not by us, but by capitalism in its military imperialist stage.
Noam Chomsky.
The Leninist system was one of the greatest blows that socialism suffered in the 20th century, maybe second only to fascism. I mean, as Lenin took power, among its first acts, along with Trotsky's, were to destroy the socialist institutions that had arisen in the pre-Bolshevik period. Soviets, factory councils, constituent assembly, which was dominated by left social revolutionaries, largely peasant-based. And of course, they went to war against the anarchists, a major war to try to wipe them out, the Makhno's army and so on. And there was a sort of a logic behind it. They were orthodox Marxists, unlike Marx, incidentally. They believed in a version of Marxism that said that revolution can't come in a backward peasant society, which is what Russia was. It was what we would now call a third world country, an undeveloped peasant society with some development, but owned by the West and so on. I mean, a highly educated and productive intellectual class, but that's also true of third world societies. So they thought this couldn't happen. So therefore we have to drive this backward population through industrialization by force. And then later on, by the iron laws of history and so on and so forth, will come the socialism. Of course, it's all nonsense. But so they essentially laid the basis for a totalitarian system with an ideological doctrine behind it. When the Soviet Union collapsed, I actually wrote an article saying this is a victory for socialism, small victory for socialism. I just couldn't get it published. Nobody knew what I was talking about. The world's two major propaganda systems, the West and the Soviet Union, they both determined to use the word socialism to refer to the totalitarian system of the Soviet Union. I mean, the West did it to discredit socialism. The Bolsheviks did it to try to gain, you know, the credit associated with genuine socialism. Well, when the world's two propaganda systems agree, it's going to be very hard for people to extricate themselves from it. So now socialism has been degraded to mean the form of totalitarianism instituted by Lenin, carried through by Stalin. And I was going back to Spain. It was entirely natural that they should be in the lead in destroying the popular revolution. Bakunin, much earlier, had predicted all of this. He said that in the future, it'll be two forms. One form will be they'll take over the state and they'll create a red bureaucracy, which will be the most vile and brutal regime the world's ever seen. And there are others who will understand that they can't take over the state, so they have to serve concentrated private power and state power. And they'll be the technical intelligentsia who implement the policies of the masters in what we now call liberal democracies, which is a very good prediction. It's one of the few predictions in the social sciences that actually came true, which is one of the reasons why nobody ever studies it. It's much too dangerous and too insightful.
In both the Soviet Union and the United States, ruling elites would set out to master the psyche of the average worker, and from the Hawthorne experiments came new insights. Researchers found that the very act of allowing workers to talk about their feelings reduced the possibility of agitation and rebellion. It made workers feel as if they mattered, even if the social relations remained fundamentally the same.
Stephen Sachs, political scientist.
The Hawthorne experiments, initially, it was to be a purely scientific study, and science tries to get rid of unnecessary things. Let's make everything equal so there aren't any other factors than the ones we're controlling for. So they were trying to see what effect changing the lighting would have on how workers felt and also how much they produced. It wasn't any really quality concern, but quantity of production and worker satisfaction, which will ultimately affect the quantity of work as well. But to do that, they said, well, we don't want to have employees being disgruntled about this and that being a factor. So we will discuss with the employees what we are going to do. There were complete discussions, and the employees would suggest trying this and trying that. And what they found was, no matter what changes they made, including putting the lighting back to where it had been before the experiment began, to see what difference that made. Every time they made a change, having discussed it with employees, production went up, and employee satisfaction went up. Now, if it had been done in a democratic context, immediately the reaction would have been, let's look at the participation. But this was done in a hierarchical context. So what came out of it was a public relations school, industrial relations developed out of it. And most of that meant was taken as a way of trying to control employees by trying to manipulate them ideologically. Not that managers hadn't done that before, but now there was a whole school of doing that. I would say the wrong lesson was learned. Yeah, put out a suggestion box so that employees can feel they're being asked, but you don't necessarily pay any attention to it. In a real teamwork organization or a participatory organization, employees get to take each other into account. They begin caring about each other. I've seen this going into a plant and seeing it develop over time, the amount of participation increase, and the attitudes of employees begin to grow and the care that people have about each other. And then that can easily expand to care about the community. And also work can be reorganized because people have a say. There are better ways to do things. If we are treated better, we'll work better, and so forth. Now, the broader social impact of doing these kinds of things, as we've seen earlier, hierarchical control makes people feel worse about themselves. It creates more mental illness, creates bad relations outside the workplace. Well, if people spend most of their time in a collaborative workplace, they become more collaborative. They care more about each other. You can have a democratic corporation, a worker-owned business, and a worker-owned business that really is managed by the workers, that uses the corporate form. And that gives us some hope because it's possible, at least theoretically, to reform corporations.
Participatory economics is the name for a different way to do the economy. It's a different approach to accomplishing production, consumption, and allocation, economic functions, different than what? Different than capitalism, and different than what went under the name socialism, but I tried to describe as coordinatorism, as this class of engineers and managers and doctors and lawyers being at the top. So participatory economics, or par econ, is an alternative to all of that. It's a different kind of economy. In a participatory economy, in a good economy, instead of organizing economic life to keep a small sector of people on top and to enrich them beyond any sensibility, and to utilize productive apparatus even when it entails doing things that are a complete waste of time, building missiles that will never be used, on and on and on. Instead of all that, we would produce and distribute for purposes of human fulfillment and development. You don't need all the advertising. You need sensible information rather than people competing with advertising that has nothing to do with actually communicating what the benefits and costs of production are. You don't need all this military production. Of course not. You don't need, nor do you want to, generate all kinds of activity and product which doesn't make people better off.
As workers around the globe continue to struggle for workplace democracy and equal rights, mass production continues apace. Taylorism, combined with human relations, make up the cornerstones of worker management in the 21st century. In China, scientific management has taken on nightmarish proportions. So extensive is the division of labor that millions of people are forced to perform roughly the same motion thousands of times a day. In the United States, workers in some assembly plants are required to be in continual motion for up to 57 seconds a minute. In Indonesia, sweatshops owned by corporations like Nike chart productivity down to a thousandth of a second. In offices and service industries, corporations are increasingly resorting to video surveillance and computerized monitoring. One of Frederick Taylor's descendants, John Taylor Gatto, has rebelled against his forebears' legacy. An award-winning teacher, he has also rebelled against the state of his profession.
An Albert Einstein quote, "Education is what remains after one has forgotten everything he learned in school." John Taylor Gatto.
The key is the word compulsion. The idea of drawing all young people into some universal program administered by the leader or the leaders is as old as Plato, probably older. But nowhere on earth was that able to be imposed until northern Germany, under the military rule of the Prussians, finally imposed that in 1818, so in the first, second decade of the 19th century. That is the first time. It was announced in other places, but never was it able to be successfully administered because the idea is so crazy and so damaging inherently that people simply disobeyed the law. The experience of Prussian Germany was that it was possible to convert sovereign human beings into human resources. That's a translation of a German compound. and that by making these people incomplete, making them unable to think in contexts, but they could be converted into specialist tools for management, scientific management. Horace Mann was hired by the railroad and coal interests of New England to bring about compulsion. He had no interest in schooling. He was an ambitious young politician. He did get compulsion laws passed in 1852. Once it was in Massachusetts, it spread very, very slowly. It wasn't for 15 more years that another state followed suit. So it hardly was a gift to the populist portion of America. I smile a little bit when I say that, because the mythology is that it was greeted everywhere with great enthusiasm.
Not only did parents resist compulsory schooling, they sometimes did so violently. So vehement was the opposition in Barnstable on Cape Cod that state militia were brought in to march children to school under armed guard. A primary reason why the mass of the American population resisted compulsory schooling was a widespread belief that its purpose had little to do with education and everything to do with control. Their suspicions were well-founded. An undercurrent of class warfare runs through early American education documents. The U.S. Bureau of Education Circular of Information for April 1872 explains that inculcating knowledge teaches workers to be able to perceive and calculate their grievances, thus making them more redoubtable foes in labor struggles. Such an enabling is bound to retard the growth of industry. 16 years later, in the report of the Senate Committee on Education, is equally explicit. We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years manifesting itself among the laboring classes.
The first Red Scare, in my judgment, is the trigger event for the embedment of compulsion schooling in the United States. The Red Scare of 1848 is probably the reason that one American state fell under the compulsion regimen. There are literally thousands of books from the period 1880 to, say, 1920, roughly, that deal with how you scientifically engineer a factory or a church congregation or young people in school. School, which followed a general outline of converting kids into obedient tools, now took on a very, very mechanistic aspect under this surge of scientific engineering.
In 1903, the Atlantic Monthly called for adoption of scientific management in schools. Prominent education theorist William C. Bagley stressed a need for unquestioned obedience. The new system would train children for life in 20th century America, their role to fulfill the needs of commerce, industry, and government.
In the community with the best education, more shoppers, more merchandise moving, a higher average of per capita sales. In the other community, fewer shoppers. Maybe things will look up in the long run. In the first community, there's a larger magazine circulation per 1,000 population. A much smaller circulation in the second community, a decline in demand. The student of typing, shorthand, and business machines becomes a producer upon graduation, a tax-developed community asset. He prepares for radio and electronics. His future promises a profit on the taxes invested in him. As education raises the cultural level, so it must also introduce youth to the know-how of production and stir interest in precision, efficiency, and service. With graduation, the community receives a new supply of young people who want a better life on the one hand and who have the ability to work for it on the other. Now the tax investment returns to the taxpayer.
In order to aid in the process, the Gary Plan was introduced. it had a new organizational scheme in which different subjects would be taught by different departments. Similar to the breaking down of factory jobs under Taylorism, students would be herded from classroom to classroom in order to digest a stream of standardized factual information. Like Pavlov's dogs, they would do so at the ring of a bell.
Children go a-sailing.
Confusion.
Send me, I'm going to send me one by one, a two was a ball and
the first lesson I saw was the terrible confusion that's in any school as people race about at bell-marked intervals. The time-honored experience of mental development is that it occurs with strong concentration, not with fragmented attention.
Class position.
You will not find the doctor's son, however ignorant he is, in the class with the marginalized kids.
Indifference.
Indifference is wonderful. This is a factory to create indifference to intellectual things, to ideas. They have to be whipped, ordered, and disciplined to do anything. Or, just as bad, they have to be offered bribes to do it.
Emotional dependency.
Sure. Probably half of the 60 million kids who attend school in the United States, removed from their own families at a very vulnerable age, become emotionally dependent on a pat on the head, a smile, avoiding an insult.
Intellectual dependency.
In spite of rhetoric to the contrary, a teacher's nightmare is invested in those kids, if any, who actually have learned how to think for themselves. The teacher's job is not only to convey bits of information that should not be challenged, but also to convey how you connect those bits of information, but not practice in doing that for yourself. You memorize someone else's connection.
What is a circle? Billy Hendler.
A circle is a closed curve in which all endpoints on the circumference are equally distanced from the center points.
Very good.
Provisional self-esteem.
Provisional self-esteem, this really ties into the grades, the test scores, the signs of approval by the teacher. You're allowed to feel good about yourself if an authority issues a signal that you can do that. On the other hand, if the authority condemns you, the only way you can feel good about yourself is to become an outlaw.
Alfie Cohn, educational theorist.
What are we trying to do? If our goal is to help kids become critical thinkers, lifelong learners who really enjoy thinking and reading and playing with numbers and ideas, if we want to help them become good learners and good people who can create and sustain a functioning democracy, then education would look very different from the way it looks right now, at least in our culture. We would have to question the use of grades. What research finds is that when kids are trying to get good grades in school, three things tend to happen. They begin to lose interest in the learning itself. Now the purpose is just to get a good grade, rather than to engage with the question or problem at hand. Second, they tend to think less deeply and retain knowledge for a shorter period of time compared to kids who don't have any grades. And third, they tend to pick the easiest possible tasks. That's not because they're being lazy, it's because they're being rational. If we tell kids we want to see a better report card, we want to see higher grades, naturally they'll pick the shortest book or the easiest project because that maximizes the chance of achieving that goal. So regardless of what your goal is, if you're interested in assessing kids and teachers and schools to see are we doing a good job here, you would never need tests in order to see whether kids are learning and where they need help. and you would never need grades to report the results of the evaluation we place on those assessments. We would certainly do away with standardized testing, the kind of testing used in particular states or provinces where everyone takes the same test and then you compare everyone's scores. These tests tend to measure what matters least. It tends to be a good marker for family income, because what standardized tests mostly measure is the size of the houses near a school. But it's the case that some of our deepest thinking kids just don't do well on tests. And some kids who get great scores have never had an original idea in their lives.
Well, I thought you just judged by tests.
Oh, no. There are many other things besides tests that we use. Of course, we do consider a child's general ability and the way he scores on standardized tests, but that's not all.
Competition builds character. In fact, what we find is that by any reasonable notion of character in terms of psychological health or self-esteem, that competition undermines that and creates a kind of neurosis, because we come to think of ourselves as good and competent only to the extent that we have defeated other people. And so we're always playing this desperate king of the mountain game, where we're all worried about triumphing over other people and stepping on their faces and looking at them as if they're going to step on our faces. That has two effects. One is it's horrible for us in terms of psychological development, because there's a perpetual sense of disease and anxiety. But second, it very logically has a destructive effect on our relationships. We compete because we're raised that way, not because we're born that way. I mean, take, for example, the belief in survival of the fittest, which is seen as a Darwinian notion. In fact, Charles Darwin never even used the phrase survival of the fittest. That was coined by a right-wing social thinker in the 19th century named Herbert Spencer, who tried to corrupt Darwin's thinking to his own reactionary political purposes. What Darwin talked about was natural selection, which means that the individual organism that's best able to adapt to a changing environment is more likely to be around to survive and reproduce. But that doesn't specify competition as a mechanism. In fact, often the active avoidance of competition, if not the deliberate pursuit of cooperative strategies, turns out to make it more likely that organisms and entire species will survive. The research consistently shows that competition not only isn't necessary for excellence, but tends to impede excellence on most tasks. And the more challenging the task, the more ingenuity, problem-solving skill it requires, the more competition tends to disrupt that achievement. Excellence pulls in one direction and competition pulls in another. And in fact, another kind of research study corroborates that. If you take a whole bunch of people and give them a task to do, some kind of problem to work out, and half of them are told, see if you can figure out how to do this task, and the other half are told, this is a contest with a prize to whoever wins, whoever does the best job. Study after study after study across cultures, across gender, across ages, find that the people who compete, who have to compete, end up doing an inferior job on that task. At the moment, it appears as though much of what happens in schools in North America is really for the convenience of people who have most of the power. There is, if anything, an active discouragement of critical questioning. Corporations claim they want kids who are able to think outside the box, but only so far as they're caught within a larger box that works to the advantage of the free market, which means that the market economy, based on competition, based on economic rather than human considerations, ends up controlling the system.
Today, many people assume that antisocial and even violent behavior by young people is a completely natural phenomenon. Yet anthropological studies reveal this to be a myth. Our widespread use of the term juvenile delinquency exposes not only the failure of modern schooling, but of an important concept given expression by the behaviorists. They called it the frustration-aggression hypothesis.
A quote by James Anthony Fowder. Fear is the parent of cruelty.
The frustration-aggression hypothesis was an attempt by behaviorists at Yale to combine their own science of behavior with that of the Freudians. Simply put, when people perceive that they are being prevented from achieving just rewards, their frustration is likely to turn to aggression. This study by the behaviorist Hobart Maurer showed that when rats could not achieve their expected reward, they began to take out their frustrations on each other. The scientist notes that two animals which have lost their hold on the pellet, frustration, will be seen to turn on each other, displaced aggression. Similarly, in a 1941 experiment, toys were placed behind a wire screen where children could see but not touch them. When they eventually gained access to the toys, their play became considerably more destructive. On the one hand, human beings are not rats. Armed with the necessary information, we can come to a logical conclusion about who is to blame for our frustrations in life. Rightly or wrongly, we often point the finger squarely back at ourselves. Yet in the hands of politicians and demagogues, frustration aggression can be a potent tool in deflecting anger onto scapegoats.
They want to throw white children and colored children into the melting pot of integration, through out of which will come a conglomerated, a lot of mongrel class of people.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specks.
We kill the faggots, we kill the lesbians. I said, God damn it, we kill them all. Why kill the elder crackers? The old crepit crackers in South Africa. How in the hell you think they got old? They got old oppressing and killing black people.
I'm not going to discuss it. If he says murder gets murdered, if a murderer gets murdered or slain, capital punishment, that's fine with me. Line them up and we'll clean up our nation overnight. Start with the abortionists. Might as well get rid of a few of those beasts.
Michael Savage, talk show host.
I'm so sick of them! I'm so sick of the brainwashing about Islam and Muslims and the Quran! Shove it! Shove it all! I'm sick of it! Take the music off. These throwbacks think they're better than you underneath it all, and 90% of them are on welfare. Speak it out at the supermarket. Tell them what you think of Islam. Tell them what you think of Muslims.
Jay Severin, talk show host.
We're talking about illegal immigration. So now, in addition to venereal disease and the other leading exports of Mexico, women with mustaches and VD, now we have swine flu. And when you scoop up some of the world's lowest of primitives in poor Mexico and drop it down in the middle of the United States, poor, without skills, without language, not sure our culture, not sure our hygiene, haven't been vaccinated, look at all the things we take for granted. It's millions of leeches from a primitive country come here to leech off you.
I don't know what happened tonight, and I don't know why.
Also, the gay agenda and Harry Potter.
Pat Robertson, evangelist.
Professors, the 101 most dangerous academics in America, and that's just a short list of the 30,000-40,000 of them. They're like termites that have worked into the woodwork of our academic society, and it's just it's appalling.
Howard Zinn, historian.
Scapegoating, and the hope is that by deflecting the anger of people, which might be directed against the system itself, deflecting the anger against these other people, the system would save itself. In the South, the black people became scapegoats, and you directed the anger of white people. Poor white people in the South were the people who joined the Ku Klux Klan. These poor white people might have rebelled against the governments of the South and against the national government, but no, they were told that black people were the source of their problem.